to hide their wealth at a dizzying pace. Taxing wealth to pay for COVID relief and economic recovery initiatives is only fair during a pandemic where lower income and people of color have been hit harshest. Today's massive concentration of wealth and power are disruptive to democratic institutions, social cohesion, and economic stability for all.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Pariskov.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة يشاء والله واسع عليم. الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون. صدق الله العلي
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Yemeni military launches two consecutive attacks on a Saudi Aramco oil facility in Jeddah and a major military base in Asir province. Defiant anti-coup protesters return to cities and towns across Myanmar a day after dozens were killed in the deadliest day of the junta's crackdown. Also in the headlines, Palestinians welcome the International Criminal Court's decision to open a probe into Israeli war crimes in the Palestinian territories, while the US firmly opposes the move. World News, we're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story, the Yemeni army has launched an attack against an Aramco oil facility in Saudi Arabia. A army spokesman, Yahya Sari', said the facility in Jeddah was targeted with a Quds II missile. There has been no immediate report of any damage. Earlier, he said the Yemeni forces also successfully hit the King Khalid Air Base in the kingdom's Asir province using drones. The Yemeni army and allied Ansar Allah forces have intensified their attacks against Saudi Arabia in response to Riyadh's years-long aggression against their country that has left tens of thousands of Yemenis dead and devastated much of the country's infrastructure. The Saudi-led coalition has also maintained an all-out blockade on Yemen, hampering even the humanitarian aid there. Activist and political commentator Hossein Al-Bukhaiti says the Yemeni army's attack on Saudi facilities is a direct warning to Washington that Yemen would continue its fight against the dire situation imposed on the country.
Exactly what the international community should look at Yemen, that they have the right to defend themselves. As you mentioned, the UN, latest UN report, which included that 400,000 Yemeni children under the age of 5 are facing death this year if there is no action or intervention will take place to stop that. And we see, actually, since Biden has took office, Saudi has blocked all ships that come in from Hodeidah, especially oil tanker. And this is actually has not happened during Trump administration. I mean, they let every now and then one or two ships to enter Hodeidah port, but Biden actually, he has enforced more blockade on Yemen, not allowing access to any ship carrying oil, and here the economy, especially hospital in Yemen, are dependent 100% on oil export from outside, and this action is affecting many hospitals and many businesses here in Yemen has closed, and many hospitals have warned that they're going to close in the coming days. That's why I think this latest attack is a direct message to the United States that the Yemeni army will continue to attack Saudi Arabia with all the means they have.
Anti-coup protesters have returned to the streets of Myanmar despite the junta's brutal crackdown that left nearly 40 people dead on Wednesday. Protesters in the cities of Dawei and Yangon condemned the crackdowns and demanded the return of civilian rule. People also flooded the city of Mandalay while fighter jets were flying over their heads. Similar rallies were held in a number of other cities. The UN Special Envoy on Myanmar has described Wednesday as the bloodiest day since the military takeover of the country on February the 1st. Over 50 anti-coup activists have been killed and some 1,200 detained since then. The army seized the power over allegation of voter fraud in November's election. It also detained civilian officials, including de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Barry Grossman is an international lawyer and joins us now. Barry, welcome. Wednesday was the deadliest day for the protesters so far, and at the same time, the protesters are displaying a certain level of defiance. What do you make of it?
Well, look, I mean, the whole thing's a tragedy. And I think there are a lot of people working at cross purposes, a lot of causes being pushed, no doubt in some part with outside instigation, and largely people working at cross purposes. Remember, it was Aung San Suu Kyi's role to essentially bring the regime closer to the West, to the United States, as part of Clinton's pivot to Asia, which, of course, was really just a kinder way of saying that the U.S. was seeking to isolate China. And of course, that didn't pan out very well, that new sort of spring in the relationship between Myanmar and the United States because of what ensued with the Rohingya. In fact, instead of getting better, of course, the plight of Rohingya in the Arakan area of Myanmar got considerably worse. And that resulted in a whole new set of sanctions being imposed on people associated with the regime in Myanmar. And of course, the junta was always in play in the background. In fact, the role, constitutionally speaking, of Aung San Suu Kyi herself has always been somewhat questionable in the sense that she's constitutionally barred from being the head of state. So having failed to deliver what members of the previous junta had hoped for, they obviously made a decision to try and get closer with China, because there remain in place, of course, plans to build a pipeline through what is Arakan, where the Rohingya are, which of course is what originally saw the Rohingya problems spark up again in 2012, and all manner of other potential avenues for cooperation between China and the regime in Myanmar. So not having realized what they had hoped, both to get both personally in terms of personal wealth and for the nation, the regime obviously decided that there wasn't much point in sticking with Aung San Suu Kyi. So that's understandable. In terms of the public response, I think they didn't expect this, you know, because the people of Myanmar had been used to living under military rule for a long time. Something seems to have changed to bring people with all sorts of different agendas together in order to protest this effectively a coup d'etat, even though the very same people that are protesting are standing beside other people who they're opposed to in many instances. So, for example, many of the protesters aren't in any way supportive of the Rohingya cause, and other protests aren't supportive of other minority causes that have been waged for a long time as a result of the hill tribes and other groups having an axe to grind with the military rule. So So it's a big cock-up. Nobody really is ending up any better off. And certainly it's a tragedy to see so many victims. But of course, it's the nature of authoritarian regimes that they will not tolerate anyone putting up any measure of resistance or protesting. And it's unfortunate that the regime hasn't managed to rein in its military to stop them from lashing out as they do, essentially murdering people in the streets.
Well, the military is coming under intense international pressure. In what direction do you think the army will take?
Well, I think they played their hand, and they're trying to get closer with China. If they were forward-looking and less concerned about their personal wealth and more concerned about the future of the country, you'd like to think that this would be an opportune time for them to resolve their differences with the Rohingya and with other minority groups that have had, historically speaking, a problem with the regime, so that at the very least, they're not taking on the entire world in terms of popular opinion and in terms of diplomatic relations. Clearly, Aung San Suu Kyi was neither able to nor seemed to have any political will to try and deliver a solution to the Rohingya people. In fact, many people formed the view that she's as responsible, as guilty as anybody in the military for what actually played out. This would be a fantastic time for the junta to seek to resolve, with China's help, the problem in Arakan, which of course arose as a result of the plans to put in a pipeline and accompanying with that domestic corruption, people trying to basically make money, greed, which is what led to the problem sort of rearing itself up again. You would like to think that China could put more pressure on the regime in order to resolve some of these problems, in order to dial everything down and deliver some measure of justice to all of the people of Myanmar. But it doesn't seem like China is that willing to get involved. After all, China rarely wants to get involved in the domestic political affairs of other nations, even when they're when they're friendly nations.
Fair enough. Barry, thank you very much. I'm afraid time has gotten the better of us. Barry Grossman, the international lawyer, joining us out of Bali. Now moving on, the U.S. Secretary of State says his country's relationship with China is the biggest geopolitical test of the 21st century.
We will manage the biggest geopolitical test of the 21st century, our relationship with China. China is the only country with the economic, diplomatic, military and technological power to seriously challenge the stable and open international system, all the rules, values, and relationships that make the world work the way we want it to, because it ultimately serves the interests and reflects the values of the American people.
Blinken said Washington's ties with Beijing may be competitive, collaborative, and adversarial, depending on the circumstances. He vowed that the U.S. would engage China from what he described as a position of strength. Tensions between the U.S. and China escalated under the former American administration. The bones of contention include Beijing's South China Sea claims, trade, espionage, the coronavirus pandemic, among other issues. The administration of President Joe Biden has halted the harsh rhetoric and near daily sanctions against China. However, it has yet to back away from the tough approach towards the Asian country. The International Criminal Court has opened a formal investigation into Israeli war crimes in the Palestinian territories. The ICC chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, announced the probe, assuring that the court will take a principled and non-partisan approach in discharging its responsibilities. Palestinians have welcomed the decision, with Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki calling it a long-awaited step. However, Israel, as well as its staunch supporter and backer, the United States, have strongly opposed the court's decision. Washington says it will continue to uphold its full commitment to Israel. Last month, the Hague-based tribunal ruled that it has jurisdiction to investigate crimes committed in the occupied West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and Jerusalem al-Quds. The ICC is set to look into Israel's 2014 war on Gaza, its settlement activities, and the regime's deadly response to anti-occupation protests in 2018. Mona Kandil says the ICC move to probe Israeli crimes shows Palestinians will finally get some justice.
It seems that the ICC is insisting to investigate the crimes. The Palestinian Authority, of course, has demanded the court to investigate the crimes, Israeli crimes committed in Gaza Strip in 2014, as well as what goes on in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, also the illegally built settlements in the occupied West Bank and in Jerusalem, Al-Quds. However, this time it seems that there will be action. But let's make it a little bit clear that Israel is not the one, as a state or a regime, going to be prosecuted. However, the ICC can prosecute figures and people, Israeli officials, military officials, Israeli ministers for committing crimes. This is exactly what the Palestinian Authority has been doing in the few years ago. They collected files and continued collecting proofs that Israeli soldiers themselves and officials committed crimes against Palestinians, whether here in the occupied West Bank, in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, or even in Gaza Strip.
Okay, we're going to stay in the region now, where a barrage of rockets has hit the Ain al-Assad airbase in western Iraq, which hosts foreign forces, including U.S. troops. Security sources have told Press TV that two American contractors were killed and six others injured in the attack. They said the type of the 10 rockets that targeted the base was similar to the model of the ones used by resistance forces between 2006 and 2010. According to the sources, the attack also caused material damage to the position of foreign forces inside the base. There has been no claim of responsibility so far. Also on Wednesday, Iraqi media reported three separate attacks on the convoys of the U.S.-led coalition. The Pentagon says Iraqi officials are investigating the attacks, adding that the U.S. won't shy away from a response if necessary. Political commentator Scott Bennett says the U.S. military presence in West Asia is unjustified.
Well, of course, the United States shouldn't even be in Iraq. It shouldn't be in Syria. It has no business being there whatsoever. It's been a terrible fiasco and a ruinous adventure, which the Zionists and the neocons and the military-industrial complex originally launched after the fraudulent 9/11 attacks, which were part of this Odin and On plan to expand the political geography and control of Israel and the Israeli Zionist U.S. hegemony over the region. And I think the entire region is absolutely sick and tired of nearly 20 years of bellicosity and bloodshed by the United States, which has done nothing but ruin the Middle East. And the only hope of healing the Middle East is through the people and tribes and bloods that live there, and letting them rejuvenate themselves by removing the toxic poisonous presence of the United States.
Elsewhere, SpaceX's Mars prototype rocket has nailed landing for the first time, but exploded soon on its landing pad. The Starship SN10 was launched from the test facility in Texas, the third such attempt to end in flames. The cause of the explosion is unclear. However, the mission was hailed as a success for its vertical landing and flying about 10 kilometers into the air. The bullet-shaped rocket was the 10th prototype of SpaceX's envisioned Mars ship. Its founder and CEO, Elon Musk, plans to use Starships to send people to the Moon and Mars. The first orbital Starship flight is planned for the end of this year, with Musk announcing that he is going to fly a Japanese billionaire around the Moon in 2023. And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
the limelight.
When the verdict came, it reduced the Paris court to a stunned silence. Nicolas Sarkozy was guilty of corruption and influence peddling and sentenced to 3 years in prison, two of them suspended. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Kim Wilshire. The piece is titled, Former French President Nicolas Sarkozy Sentenced to Jail for Corruption. Stay with us for more of Kim Wilshire's article. When the verdict came, it reduced the Paris courtroom to a stunned silence. Nicolas Sarkozy was guilty of corruption and influence peddling and sentenced to 3 years in prison, two of them suspended. France's president from 2007 to 2012 had played an active role in forging a corruption pact with his lawyer and a senior magistrate to obtain information on a separate investigation into political donations, the leading judge declared, and there was serious and concurring evidence of collaboration between the three men to break the law. The conviction and sentence were dramatic, unexpected, and historic. Nicolas Sarkozy, 66 years old, had repeatedly declared his innocence and dismissed the charges as an insult to my intelligence. It is, however, unlikely he will spend a day in jail. His lawyer has announced he intends to appeal the decision, a process that could lead to a new trial and a one-year prison sentence can be served outside of jail under certain conditions, including the wearing of an electronic bracelet or limited home confinement. Sarkozy did not comment as he left the courtroom, but his wife, the supermodel turned singer Carla Bruni, on Instagram described the verdict as an injustice. Quel acharnement insensé, mon amour. Le combat continue, la vérité fera jour. Which translates as, what relentless nonsense, my love. The battle continues, the truth will out. And that was from Carla Bruni's official Instagram account. While Sarkozy was not banned from holding public office, the verdict delivered on Monday afternoon, 1st of March 2021, is likely to quash his hopes of returning to public life in time for next year's presidential elections in France. His centre-right, Le Républicain Party, LR Party, has been struggling to come up with a credible candidate since Sarkozy's former Prime Minister, François Fillon, was engulfed in scandal during the 2017 presidential race, opening the way for the current president, Emmanuel Macron, to win. At his trial last year, the court heard how Nicolas Sarkozy instructed his lawyer, Thierry Herzog, to offer the senior magistrate, Gilbert Azibert, a cushy job in the Côte d'Azur in return for information on an investigation into whether he had received donations from the ailing L'Oréal heiress, Liliane Bettencourt. The Bettencourt case was eventually dropped, but by then, an investigation into corruption and influence peddling had been opened. The judge, Christine May, the president of the tribunal, said there was serious evidence of a corruption pact between Nicolas Sarkozy, Thierry Herzog, and Gilbert Azibert. Herzog, age 65, and Azibert, 73, were given similar sentences of 3 years imprisonment, two of them suspended. The case, based on telephone taps, became known as the Bismuth Affair. Paul Bismuth was the name the former president Nicolas Sarkozy employed in connection to two burner telephones used to communicate with Thierry Herzog. French detectives began monitoring Sarkozy's communications in September of 2013 as part of an investigation into claims he had received an illegal and undeclared 50 million euro donation from the former Libyan strongman and dictator Muammar Gaddafi to fund his successful 2007 presidential campaign. What they heard, though, from the recorded conversations pointed investigators in a new and unexpected direction. They revealed the former president, Sarkozy, and his lawyer, Thierry Herzog, were secretly communicating using mobile telephones registered under false names. Additional wiretaps on these phones picked up conversations suggesting Sarkozy had been in contact with Gilbert Azibert, then a member of the Cour de Cassation, the highest court in France, via Thierry Herzog to request confidential information about the Liliane Bettencourt case. Nicolas Sarkozy, who is embroiled in several legal cases, has repeatedly denied accusations of any wrongdoing in all past and present investigations. He spent years attempting to have the bismuth charges thrown out and the case dismissed. Thierry Herzog argued the secretly recorded conversations between him and former President Sarkozy were covered by client-lawyer privilege and could not be used as evidence. Before his trial last year, Nicolas Sarkozy had said he welcomed the hearing as a chance to clean my name. "I am combative. I have no intention of being accused of things I haven't done. I'm not corrupt, and what has been inflicted on me is a scandal that will rest in the annals. The truth will out," Nicolas Sarkozy told BMF TV. The former French president is expected to appear in court later this month in yet another case, the Big Malian affair, in which he is accused of overspending on his 2012 re-election bid. Nicolas Sarkozy is also being investigated on allegations of influence peddling and laundering of crime and misdemeanor related to consulting activities in Russia. Sarkozy's supporters have accused French judges of making the former president the target of an unfair and relentless legal crusade. He's the first former president to appear in court on criminal charges. His predecessor, Jacques Chirac, was charged and convicted, received a 2-year suspended sentence over fake jobs at City Hall when he was the mayor of Paris, but was spared taking the stand in the courtroom because of ill health. At the end of his 2-week trial last year, Sarkozy said, "This case has been for me the stations of the cross, but if that was the price to pay for the truth to come out, I'm ready to accept it. I still have confidence in the justice of our country." His lawyer, Thierry Herzog, was also convicted of breaching the rules of professional secrecy between him and his client. Thierry Herzog and Gilbert Azibert have announced they will appeal the court's decision and they will appeal against their conviction. After the verdict, Damien Abad, the president of Les Républicains, or LR parliamentary group, tweeted, "Today I want to again express my friendship with President Nicolas Sarkozy. His life has been a succession of trials that he has never ceased to overcome with energy and courage. Once again, he will prove this. I'm certain of it."
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
Thank you for being with us. My name is Amina Taylor, and we're broadcasting from the British capital. Now we begin with our top story. Because Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has given evidence in an investigation into her handling of sexual harassment allegations against her predecessor Alex Salmond. Once the duo leading the fight for Scottish independence, they're now embroiled in a scandal that could derail efforts to break away from the United Kingdom. In this report, Bianca Rahimi fills us in.
Raise your right hand, First Minister, and repeat after me.
This is the moment Nicola Sturgeon has been waiting for, the chance to prove she did not plot to bring down her former mentor. She is accused of botching an investigation into sexual harassment charges against her predecessor, Alex Salmond, holding key meetings in her home regarding the complaints, breaking the ministerial code, and repeatedly lying to Parliament. Amid calls to resign, she faced a committee of the Scottish Parliament Wednesday and reiterated her position.
A number of women made serious complaints about Alex Salmond's behaviour. The government, despite the mistake it undoubtedly made, tried to do the right thing. As First Minister, I refused to follow the age-old pattern of allowing a powerful man to use his status and connections to get what he wants. The police conducted an independent criminal investigation. The Crown Office, as it does in prosecutions every single day of the week, considered the evidence and decided there was a case to answer. A court and a jury did their jobs, and now this committee and an independent investigation are considering what happened and why.
Sturgeon now has a delicate balance to strike as a woman and a politician. She says she didn't know there were alleged concerns about Salmond's sexual behaviour, but later was convinced by Salmond himself that something inappropriate did happen.
And although he denied the allegations, he gave me his account of one of the incidents complained of, which he said he had apologised for at the time. What he described constituted, in my view, deeply inappropriate behaviour on his part. Perhaps another reason why that moment is embedded so strongly in my mind.
Two key witnesses have now provided damning evidence Sturgeon repeatedly misled Parliament, corroborating Alex Salmond's version of events. He gave evidence on the 26th of February and accused the government of withholding documents pertaining to the case and damaging Scotland's reputation.
Some people say that the failures of these institutions, the blurring of the boundaries between party, government and prosecution service, mean that Scotland is in danger of becoming a failed state. I disagree. The Scottish civil servant hasn't failed. Its leadership has failed.
What hangs in the balance here is not just Nicola Sturgeon's career, but her lifelong goal to see an independent Scotland. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has slapped down her demands for a new referendum as irrelevant and unnecessary. Nonetheless, she has vowed to hold a new independence vote if she wins a majority in May's Holyrood elections. However, First, she must stave off demands for her to resign and survive a no-confidence vote in Parliament. Bianca Rahimi, London.
And Mick Napier, political commentator in Edinburgh, joins us at the moment. And Mick, are you watching this from behind your fingers as this drama plays itself out? How do you think it's going?
Well, for those of us who support independence, this is a catastrophe. Everyone uses the word botched for the way the government has handled the allegations. We know there was something wrong. Alex Salmond even had to apologise for his inappropriate behaviour towards women to whom he was senior, and there's not much of a way back from that in this period after Me Too. And there's also issues of the Lord Advocate being too close to the... I mean, there's a constitutional issue here that he sits in the cabinet and he's not altogether the impartial legal expert that he should be. So, I mean, the government was found guilty of bias. It's not an allegation of bias. They were found the whole investigation into Salmond was tainted with bias, and it was resisting that conclusion that led the government to squander £600,000. This is a small country. That's a lot of money. And we now see that although Alex Salmond should have been vulnerable to allegations of inappropriate behaviour, he went in front of a jury of 8 women and 5 men, and every single charge was thrown out. Those members of the jury must have been influenced, but not in the jury room. They must have been influenced by allegations of a kind of conspiracy. Indeed. And we saw the documents that were forced to be released by the Scottish Government. They dug in to prevent certain documents being released, and it was only the threat of a no-confidence vote on the Deputy First Minister that forced some of them to be handed over to the Parliamentary Committee.
Of course, Mick, but now with this, I guess the real question here is Westminster's just clutching its hands together in glee. How harmful has this been for the future of Scotland's independence movement?
There were 22 public opinion polls in a row, each of them showing either the same or an increasing majority for independence. The 23rd poll, commissioned recently amidst this huge fight between the two most popular and high-profile politicians in Britain over decades, has shown that the majority has disappeared. To get independence, to get the majority, to get it over the line, even starting off with 58% majority, would be a huge effort. And the SNP is viewed by many of its members even, including MPs, as purely an instrument for achieving independence, after which they would decamp to some other political formation. So for independence-minded individuals in Scots, and that's the majority, it really is a disaster. Who benefits? Johnson. Those people who wish to maintain the integrity of the United Kingdom.
Indeed. Mick, we're going to continue to watch this one because I dare say it will play on and on, especially as we lead up into May. Thank you. Now, the United States has imposed sanctions on several Russian officials and on more than a dozen businesses over the alleged poisoning of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Washington announced earlier today that sanctions were an attempt to send a clear signal to the Russians regarding their behavior, adding that the move was in conjunction with the European Union's announcements of penalties levied on other individuals accused of the same allegations. Now, Moscow has strongly denied any wrongdoing and warned Washington to, quote, not play with fire, adding that the U.S. must not lecture other nations on human rights, as the North American country is itself a serious violator of international peace treaties and has a history of human rights abuses. Well, in the past couple of hours, British Chancellor Rishi Sunak has announced his second budget, a year after he took the job and a month before coronavirus upended Britain's economy. Well, we're going to cross to Sai Poreza, who's outside Britain's Parliament for us, with his highlights of the Chancellor's announcements. It's wet, it's rainy, Saeed, but what were the highlights for you?
We were hoping for the rain to let up, but it still to do that. As you say, the Chancellor came up with that announcement in the early hours of this afternoon in the House of Commons. He started out by telling the British public the huge amount of money that the government has spent on the COVID response. He went on to reiterate that his top priority is to keep jobs and to protect British livelihoods. And to do so, he went on to say that the furlough scheme, the job retention scheme, so-called, that has helped keep in employment some 11 million people over the past year, will be extended until September, the end of summer. He also mentioned that the support for the unemployed will still be extended till the end of September. He also went on to say that the so-called stamp duty holiday, stamp duty is the tax that you pay to the government when you buy a property, that it'll also be extended till June. Also, the so-called mortgage guarantee scheme, whereby if you're a first-time home buyer, you pay 5% up front and the government underwrites the 95% that you will take in the form of a mortgage or home loan from a financial institution, plus the $1.6 billion more to be injected into the vaccination rollout, as we know, is in full swing in this country at the moment, and a whole host of other issues for which funding has been announced, including how to tackle the climate emergency.
How was this received, and why is he doing and taking some of the measures that he is at the moment?
Well, I can tell you, the people have been watching this, as the critics, the opposition, they weren't complimentary at all. In fact, we heard from the leader of the Labour Party, the opposition Labour Party, Sarah Keir Starmer, saying for things like, it is hard to put a positive spin looking at this, looking at the decisions of the past year and the neglect, in his words, of the past 10 years, taking a jab at the conservative governments that have been in power over the past decade. He went on to say that this budget simply papers over the cracks and that it only defers the problem. He brought up the issue of the more than 4 million Brits who now live in poverty among children. And the decisions that this government has taken since the pandemic struck, which, for example, was the government ignoring the so-called circuit breaker called for by the opposition and scientists to bring down the reproduction.
All right, Saeed Poureza, for us in a wet, rainy London. Thank you very much. Now we move to some developing news, because the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court has launched a formal inquiry into Israel's war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories. Now, Fatou Bensouda said it will be conducted independently, impartially, and objectively, without fear or favor. In 2019, Bensouda said there was a reasonable basis to open a war crimes probe into Israeli military actions in the Gaza Strip, which killed thousands in 2014 alone, as well as Israeli settlement activity in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Authority and Hamas have welcomed the investigation, but Tel Aviv strongly opposes it. Now, three men and a woman have pleaded not guilty to a charge of criminal damage over their alleged role in the toppling of a statue erected to honor 17th century slave trader Edward Colston. The monument was toppled last year and pushed into UK town's Bristol's harbor after global anti-racism protests began following the killing of the American black man George Floyd by police officers. The toppling of the statue led to other memorials of controversial figures in the UK being pulled down and kick-started debates over the UK's colonial legacy. The official trial of the Colston Four is set to begin on December the 13th and is expected to last several days. Well, Richard Sudan is going to be with us shortly, just awaiting his arrival on our social media section.
This is European News Bulletin, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
There you are, Richard. Wondered what had happened to you for a brief moment there, but bring us up to speed. We're talking Meghan and Harry.
So, yes, Amina, it's very interesting watching this drama play out because Meghan Markle is being attacked by the UK media yet again. But what's interesting is a lot of people are actually saying that whatever your opinion of the UK royal family might be, whichever side you're on, a lot of people are saying that, look, here's Meghan Markle, a black woman who married into the royal family. The royal family is arguably the most powerful, privileged white family, possibly in recorded human history. That wealth was accumulated by the plunder of countries of black people and non-white people. And you have Prince Andrew born into this family with allegations that he's potentially linked to possibly the most wide-reaching sex scandal in history, led by Jeffrey Epstein, and yet people are saying there's a disproportionate focus on Meghan Markle by the media, and some are suggesting this kind of malaise might actually tell us as much about the UK state as indeed the history of the monarchy. Of course, you know, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle have been in the press for a while now, but, you know, this is the fundamental point really being made here. People are saying this is shifting focus away from Prince Andrew, who many think, many are arguing, mm-hmm. should be part of a criminal inquiry, or at least should be questioned by the authorities. But, of course, he's not. And so, you know, inevitably, Amina, this has created a firestorm online, which is brewing, and it's been there for a while now.
Just give me two of your favorite tweets, Rich.
Got to go to the commentator, James O'Brien, first, who says, if an independent inquiry finds that Meghan Markle bullied staff members, she should be sacked as Home Secretary immediately. Now, this, of course, is a nod to Priti Patel, who faced the Home Secretary, who faced very real accusations of bullying. And let's go to Femi, on Twitter, who says, according to the UK press, Meghan Markle can not only cause droughts and murder her with brunches, but she can chop up journalists with her jewellery. Compared to her, what's a child sex trafficking ring between mates? Am I right? A very tongue-in-cheek satirical comment there from Femi.
All right, we move on to our next story. Equally disturbing in its own way.
Very much so. There's been reports and activists and experts which are saying that the rise in Islamophobia in so-called liberal Canada is being reflected in a number of attacks which have taken place in public spaces against Muslim women wearing the hijab, and within that category, specifically black Muslim women wearing the hijab. There have been at least five recorded attacks in recent days, but of course, Amina, those are only the attacks that we know about. And people are basically demanding immediate action on the issue. They want people to feel safe. They want Muslims and Muslim women to be safe and feel safe in the public sphere. But actually, other people are making the point that, look, with Justin Trudeau as Prime Minister, with his checkered history, is any action really going to be taken? Because Justin Trudeau was known for wearing blackface, which is hugely offensive to black people and hugely offensive to anyone who's on, you know, the right side of the anti-racism cause. But this is cause for alarm. I mean, Islamophobia is a global phenomenon, and we're seeing it, you know, rear its head in the streets in Canada, and this is causing massive concern for all those with an eye on the issue.
Indeed. Your top two tweets?
Let's go to Sarah Mushtaq, first of all, who says, visibly Muslim women are the most susceptible to hate crimes, with black Muslim women being even more vulnerable, as demonstrated by the last few months. Saying this is not us or things must change is not enough right now and wasn't enough in the past. And let's go to Morel Andrews, who says, it's International Women's Day 2021 in just a few days. And in Canada, we need to take real action on targeting violence like this. It's disgusting. And many comments are like this online at present, Amina.
It really is. And for all of us concerned, let's hope everyone keeps safe. Thank you very much, Richard. Shifting gears now, because Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has announced that his government is working on a series of measures that will, quote, improve rights and freedoms in the country. In a televised address, the Turkish leader stated that the new measures to be implemented over the next 2 years would include improved press freedoms and freedoms of expression, as well as attempts to reduce violence against women. During his statement, Erdogan declared that the measures were also an attempt to improve negotiations with Brussels over the attachment of Turkey to the EU. His comments come months after the European Union slammed limited sanctions on Ankara
over the dispute in the Eastern Mediterranean concerning hydrocarbon exploration disagreements with Greece. Disturbing news coming out of Myanmar, Ahmed Kabbalah.
Yes, the violence against the anti-coup protesters doesn't seem to be going away, as more are critically injured, as more videos are emerging on social media, on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, of the army and the police cracking down on protesters. We can see health workers and health volunteers being attacked by the police, protesters being attacked, shots being fired. We've got a tweet from Tom King, who says, Myanmar is becoming a one-sided war zone. The police and the military are arresting protesters en masse and brutality and indiscriminately torturing and killing civilians. Lack of action from the international community is astounding. Urgent action must be taken. Now, there is another side to this story that some are keen to voice on social media, and that's this violence isn't new to Myanmar, but it had been previously dished out to the Rohingya community in the Rakhine state. And it was supported, that violence was supported by the National League of Democracy, the party of Aung San Suu Kyi and her supporters. And now that violence is coming back to haunt them. And we've got a tweet from Ashok who says, in 2017, when Myanmar army attacked the Rohingya, those who kept quiet or sided with the barbarity are now facing the wrath of the criminal force. It is thus an important to raise your voice when others are attacked. Don't wait till they come after you. And this is a lesson that many people in Sudan also learn, because when the violence was being dished out in Darfur and the Nuba Mountains, many Sudanese people ignored it until it came to the streets of Khartoum, Omdurman and Bahrain. Now, Kenneth Roth, who is the executive director of Human Rights Watch, who's not always right on these topics, but he's right on this point. He says, videos show Myanmar soldiers and police officers using shotguns, flashbangs, tear gas grenade launchers and rifles to attack anti-coup protesters. At least one of the unit involved in the crackdown had been implicated in atrocities against the Rohingya Muslims.
Strong points to move on to our second story, Ahmed.
Yeah, this is a story that will shock many people, particularly because we are in 2021, and that is Pontins, which is a British holiday residence, used a blacklist of common Irish names to keep traveller families out of holiday parks. Now, this story is shocked many people online because there was this blacklist of undesirable guests, and who would make the list of undesirable guests would be determined by their surname, and if they had an Irish sounding surname, such as Boyle, Delaney, Gallagher, and so on. And some people are saying this is actually reminds them of the 60s and the 70s in the UK, where you would see signs like no blacks, no Irish, no dogs, and actually reminds them of the mistreatment of Irish people that dates back to the 16th century, with Ireland being Britain's first colony. And some people argue that Ireland is still a colony of the UK because the UK continues to occupy the six counties known as Northern Ireland. Now, Howard Beckett says, as a proud Irishman, this repulses me to my core. There can be no place for anti-Irish racism in society. Martin says, genuinely gobsmacked by the racism discrimination shown by Pontins, refusing cancelling bookings based on people's names. It seems like something from the 1950s. Shameful. Well done, whichever staff member blew the whistle. And final tweet on this, Chris says, absolutely vile and disgusting behaviour by Pontins. I would say I'll never go there again due to this behaviour, but having visited Pontins once, I'll never go there again because of how bloody awful the place was.
Ouch, that's got to hurt. I mean, it's one thing to be accused of clear, rampant racism, but it's quite another to have your breakfast questioned in such obvious terms. All right, Ahmed Kabbalah, we're going to leave it there for the moment. Thank you. And we're going to leave you for the time being as well. So thank you so much for sticking with this broadcast. Until next time, stay safe.
in the limelight.
Trump has been unusually quiet about his future plans, but sources close to the former president say that in his upcoming speech at the annual Conservative Political Action Conference in Florida, he will attempt to brand himself as both the current leader of the GOP as well as the presumptive nominee for 2024 presidency.